All right, I'd like to welcome everyone to our October 20th, 2020 special meeting of the Marysville Board of Education. Can I have a roll call, please?
Mr. Luke? Ms. Savage?
Here.
Ms. Powers?
Here.
Mr. Smith?
Here.
Ms. Devine?
Here. Thank you. And first up tonight, we are going to be hearing from our treasurer with the five-year forecast overview. So thank you again for letting us delay it to tonight. I think it's better that we're all kind of fresh and ready to hear all these numbers. So,
yep. Thank you. Okay, so you can go to the next slide, please. So the first slide compares revenues versus expenditures and then shows our ending cash balance in the green line there. This slide really tells the story of the forecast. As you can see, the blue line there representing revenue has been relatively flat and actually starts to decrease, which kind of creates a problem in the forecast, which is why you see the ending cash balance start to drop so significantly, because expenditures do continue to increase. There's multiple reasons why we're seeing that revenue line go down. One of the most significant reasons is House Bill 920, which we've talked about. That is where school districts don't get increases based on existing levies. So when valuations go up, tax rates actually go down so that the revenues we receive stay relatively the same. Another big reason that revenues are going down is state funding, which we'll talk about in a later slide, as well as the PPP revenue. Again, we'll talk about in a later slide. And then also interest revenues are going down significantly. Basically, we're cut in half on our projections for this year, a loss of over $300,000 due to interest rates really just dropping significantly. Next slide, please. This slide shows our cash balance policy. The first one there, comparing the dotted line there of ending cash balance compared to having 1 month of expenses. You can see in fiscal year 23, we're okay, and then in fiscal 24, that ending cash balance drops below that. Mm-hmm. So starting in fiscal 24, we're not meeting our cash balance policy there. And then the other aspect of that is having revenues exceeding expenditures by 1%. And that starts a little earlier, where in fiscal year 22, we start having expenditures exceeding revenues by 1%. So what this slide tells us, and having that cash balance policy, it indicates something needs to be done. You know, I can't just say, well, that just automatically means we need to pass a levy, because obviously you can also look at the expenditure side of things. But when you have revenues actually declining, it's hard to say that you're going to just make expenditures decline so you can avoid a levy. You know, when revenues are actually going down, I think at that point we know the levy is necessary. The next slide looks at our revenue sources, and this is a slide that, if you remember, each of the last several years, we're seeing a shift here, where you look at our state sources of revenue versus our local sources. For this year, we're looking at around 53% of our revenues coming from local sources and 46% coming from state. That number's been shifting by about 2% each year for the last 3 years, meaning a higher burden is put onto our local property taxes. But also, I want to point out that shift isn't happening because revenues are going up. You know, that shift isn't happening because local property taxes are going up or people are paying more taxes. The shift is happening because state revenue is going down. So this slide looks a little closer at our state revenues. Kind of the good news right now is the state economy has really recovered much quickly than I think a lot of people expected. They're really pretty close back to their original projections. What that means is if things continue, then we shouldn't expect any future cuts. Mm-hmm. Now, that obviously gets blown out of the water if there's another, you know, huge shutdown and things like that. But as of now, we're not expecting any future cuts in the forecast. And you may remember our current state funding formula that we're on, we were basically guaranteed to stay at our fiscal year 19 funding levels for fiscal 20 and fiscal 21. There really is no formula. It was just basically a guarantee. And then obviously that guarantee got broken, so it wasn't much of a guarantee. So in fiscal year 20, we lost $1 million in state funding. And then in fiscal year 21, you may remember our original projection was a 10% cut, which would have been over $2 million. That number ended up coming in less at only 5%, so it was actually an identical cut to what we received last year. So we lost an additional $1 million. So, you know, depending on how you look at it, that's good news because we didn't lose as much, but at the same time, that's $2 million in state revenue that we've lost over the last 2 years. Due to the state economy improving, we're just assuming for fiscal years 22 through 25 in the forecast that we're going to return to that fiscal year 19 funding level. Honestly, at this point, that's kind of anybody's guess. Mm-hmm. You may be hearing in the news that, and we've talked in the past about the Cutt-Patterson formula that could potentially be in play. Beginning in fiscal 22, that will be a new biennial budget, and there could be a new funding formula at that point. We still don't know yet what that Cutt-Patterson would potentially do for Marysville. I do know that based on our property growth, because they would be looking at a newer set of property valuations as opposed to what they were looking back in fiscal 19, and we're just going to look even stronger because of the increases we've had over those last several years. So we would be in the top quintile of property values, and at the same time, as we've talked about, our local tax effort is pretty low because we're pretty close to the minimum that you can have in effective millage. So I say that to say that I'm not really optimistic that a new funding formula would benefit us significantly. I don't think that they would look at us and say, you need more state funding. They're most likely going to look and say, well, you just need to increase your levies, levy millage. This next slide, I haven't shown this for a while, but it's really, it's kind of like we've kind of come to, the Piper's come calling today because of what happened long ago. You know, the tangible personal property tax revenue we used to receive was $9 million annually at its peak, which equates to about 10 mils, mm-hmm. and that's revenue that was lost. And we were getting tangible personal property reimbursement payments, which is in that part of that state revenue. Right now, that's dropping by between $500,000 and $600,000 per year. So in the forecast, the five projected years of the forecast, we're losing basically 3 mils of revenue because of that tangible personal property tax going away. Property values increased. We had a reappraisal for tax year 19. You can see the class 1 total. That was an increase of almost $80 million. Almost $80 million. That's going to be your residential. So obviously, property values for our residents, that's a strong indicator of a good economy in our community. Class 2, which is commercial, actually decreased by $3 million. That's an area where we would like to start seeing some increases so that it would take a little bit of that burden off of our local property taxpayers and have the local businesses pick up a little bit more of that burden. Public utility personal property tax, the PUP tax in purple there, that line increased again slightly, which has been a big boost to help the district over the last several years. I just want to point out what this slide shows. Again, it really points to the impact of House Bill 920 on the district, because if that didn't exist, then that 9.4% increase in property values would have meant we would be getting a 9.4% increase in real estate tax revenue as well. So, you know, if that were the case, we would, probably wouldn't be talking about a levy at this point because we would have gotten a nice increase in revenues. Next update is going to be the triennial update will be in 2022, and we're projecting a 3.79% increase for that. Next slide looks at expenditures. Really, most of our object lines there are pretty much on track where we expect. The main line I want to mention is just our benefits, our health insurance. That's the main line that's kind of the kind of growing at a higher rate than any of the other expenditure lines. For this year, for January 1, we're looking at most likely a slightly over 13% increase for our health insurance. You may be hearing in the news with insurance that it's actually going well this year because people weren't using the insurance. But what we're looking at expecting next year would be what they're calling the COVID bump, where people that couldn't go get these elective procedures done this year, which saved insurance funds money, that's going to, and it's already started already, will pick up, and you'll see a bump now as well as next year as people kind of catch up on those things that they couldn't do during the lockdown. In each year of the forecast, we're projecting a 10% increase in insurance. So that's an area where if we do get some good claims years, I think there's definitely a possibility we could see some savings in those years. But so far, in the last few years, we just have not had good claims years to where that 10% is kind of where we're expecting. Since we're talking about a potential levy upcoming, we wanted to discuss the levy history. There's been one new money levy issue passed since 1998, and that was in 2008. So if you look at that levy timeline, there was a decade in between levies, and now for the next levy, we're looking at probably around 14 years. Mm-hmm. So you have a 10-year levy cycle there, and then another 14 years between levies. In the forecast that we're looking at, I do not have any levies simulated in there. That's something that we can do in a future forecast just to show what the impact of those would be. And then just looking at the big picture, as I mentioned, you know, the good news is that we were looking at a lot worse scenarios back in May. You know, we were assuming a 10% cut in state funding. We were concerned that there could have been potential federal cuts to our federal grants. And there was also concern, you know, what was going to happen with real estate taxes. Would we see a lot of delinquencies there, which has not been the case so far. So the forecast definitely improved. But one of the biggest risks here is, as I mentioned, there's still a lot of uncertainty with our state revenue and what a new potential state funding formula would look like. With two new biennial budgets that would be in those projected years. The current projections show the need for passing a levy in 2022 so that we could then begin collecting revenues off that levy in 2023. If you look just at the ending cash balance, you know, you might be able to say, well, you really wouldn't need to collect until 2024. But in holding off that long, that gap of expenditures versus revenues only gets bigger. And if we waited that long, the levy ask would be much, much higher, a number that we wouldn't want to have to ask for. And two, that levy wouldn't last as long because it would be eaten up so quick because of the gap. So as I mentioned, since revenues are actually decreasing, and expenditures obviously are going to usually grow at least at the rate of inflation, we're looking almost at potentially becoming on a levy cycle, like what you see in most of the Central Ohio districts where they're having to go for a new levy every 3 or 4 years, because without revenue growth, that's the only way you're going to get additional revenues to keep up with expenditures is through a levy. Mm-hmm. That's why you're going to see, because like in Olin Tangy's, they haven't gotten any very significant state funding growth, so they're asking for new levies every 3 or 4 years. We would like to avoid that. We don't really want to be on a levy cycle every 3 or 4 years. And as I mentioned, to do that, we need to have revenue growth. So one potential way that could happen is if we were on the 20 mil floor. If you're on the 20 mil floor, House Bill 920 isn't really in effect. So if you're on the 20 mil floor and property tax values go up, so does your tax revenue. So if we were on the 20 mil floor and we got a 10% increase in valuation, then our tax revenues would go up by around 10% as well. Right now, our effective millage for the general fund is 24 mils, so we're only 4 mils away from getting on the 20 mil floor. The way that you get onto the 20 mil floor is as property values go up, effective millage goes down because of House Bill 920. Because with the most recent reappraisal, our millage went down by, I think it was 2 point some mils.
Okay.
So it decreased, maybe it's around 3.
Mm-hmm.
So as those values continue to go up, our millage continues to go down, we're going to get closer to that 20 mil floor. If we actually end up hitting the 20 mil floor, then we would be able to start seeing revenue increases from at least one source of revenue. Right now, our projections, based on what we're expecting to see with property tax values, would be 2025, maybe 2026, of being on the 20 mil floor. The reason I bring that up is that would impact what type of levy we would want to pass. If we passed a traditional continuing levy for this next levy, basically the 20 mil floor would never be an option. It would wipe that idea out. We wouldn't be in play. Whereas if we looked at passing an emergency levy, the emergency levy does not count towards your millage towards the 20 mil floor. So that would potentially give us an option to where we could pass a levy, get the revenue that we need to maintain services, but also still potentially be able to see revenue growth in the future to hopefully stay off of the levy cycle or make future levies so that they're not as, maybe not be as large of an ask.
Mm-hmm.
And then further down the road, like around 2030, we'll have also some TIFs that are going to be coming off the books. So that's valuation that currently we're not getting full tax revenue on that would be expiring, and then that would come onto our valuation, so revenues would increase there as well. So there's a few things out there that could help us to avoid, that levy cycle of having to come back to the voters every 4 years. So that I think we want to try to aim for that if we can. And the last thing I wanted to mention, because in our finance committee meeting, the question was asked about enrollment and, what are you projecting for enrollment? Because obviously, we're looking at there could be some growth. The forecast right now does not project significant enrollment. The main reason is because if I put large enrollment growth in there, it would have no impact on our state revenue. Right now, since we're on that guarantee number, changing the enrollment does nothing for our revenue. Our most recent enrollment projections showed that we would be relatively flat, but at the same time, you're seeing apartments go up.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing housing go up,
mm-hmm.
So there's a potential that that enrollment will start to grow. But as of now, I'm not projecting that in the forecast because it really has no impact on the revenue. If it grew significant enough, would end up impacting expenditures where mm-hmm. we would have to hire additional staff. But as of now, that's not in the projections. That's it. If there's any questions.
This is not just for you, but anybody who's been paying attention. Like the $2 million that was cut, $1 million last year and $1 million this year. Is there any chance any of that will come back? Because you mentioned, one, that the economy recovered quicker than people expected, so the state may be doing better. And also, there's another stimulus package that's being kicked around from the federal government that I haven't been paying close enough attention to know if there's money for the states in there or not. So, and then the second question is, if any of that could come back, would that make any difference in the levy schedule that you're outlining?
Yeah, so a couple things there. One, you know, if that money came back, I mean, I would not anticipate it would come back like where the state would say, well, here's part of that revenue back on state funding. It would be more likely, well, here's some additional federal grants. So, I mean, that's possible that there could be some more federal stimulus money coming our way. I think that is possible. And as I mentioned in the forecast, we're assuming that money comes back, not like, you know, here's that $2 million you lost, but in fiscal 22, we at least get back to normal. Mm-hmm. And then the second part of that is, you know, if that came back, does that change the levy? I would say no, it doesn't change the levy timeline. It would potentially change the millage ask, though. Mm-hmm.
And the other question I have is the continuing levy is one thing, and what's the other one called?
An emergency levy.
So how many years would that be for?
An emergency levy can be anywhere from 1 to 10 years. Okay. I think in on average, when you see an emergency levy, the school district, it's usually 5 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then that levy can actually, after that levy expires, there was a change in law, I don't know, sometime within the last 5 years, I'm going to say, you can actually change that emergency levy into, I think it's called a substitute continuing levy or conversion levy or something to that effect. And the benefit of that is you could turn that emergency levy into a continuing levy and still not have it count against your millage for the 20 mil floor. Mm-hmm. So it gives us that benefit of giving us time to see what if the 20 mil floor is attainable. While still being able to pass a levy.
So that emergency levy is not so much a millage, but just a flat dollar amount?
Correct.
Okay, but it would be, like, for us, it would be based on the valuation of our properties,
in essence, it would be the same.
As a millage,
yeah,
but just
millage.
You don't see that.
The only real difference is going to be that, you know, when a voter is going to see the levy resolution language, it's not going
right.
to say, you know, this is a 7 or 8 mil levy. It's going
right.
to have, this is a this many million dollars.
Gotcha.
Levy. Kind of like a bond issue, how the
okay.
wording would be.
Okay.
So the TPP tax elimination, when is that scheduled to completely fall off?
Around 25 or 26, we'll go down. We'll be at zero at that point, no longer getting revenue. I think right now we're getting it's around $2.5 million this year, I believe, that we're still getting.
Yeah.
Okay, and you had just referenced that we're losing like 3 mil a year.
3 mil.
No, and so if you look at the projected years of the forecast, so we've got 5 years projected in the forecast. If you add up what we're losing over those 5 years, that equates to 3 mil.
Oh, combined.
Combined, yeah. Which, again, when nothing else, not a single other revenue area is increasing,
right.
that is, you know, that hurts exponentially.
Right. Have you seen anything yet from the Cutt-Patterson simulations? Okay.
No. Yeah, they're
still
supposed to have come out
like a while ago.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
In Todd, in terms of what we've told the public looking forward to mm-hmm. a levy, are we going to be able to keep our, I guess you'd call a promise? As to when the tax would be collected on the people, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
taxpayers in the district.
Yeah, I think when we talked about future levies, when we were at our last levies, passage, you know, we said that we were going to need a new levy in fiscal year 23.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, does that mean you collect fiscal year 23 covers two calendar years, 22 and 23. So we're really, you know, looking at passing it in 22 to collect in 23, mm-hmm. which will be, in essence, part of fiscal year 23. Now, originally I expected it would be probably a little later than that, probably mm-hmm. passing it in 23 and collecting in 24.
Mm-hmm.
But since that time, which has been several years ago, things have gone downhill on the revenue side to where we're up about a year sooner than what I would have thought back then.
Well, and with revenue going down, was increased by the most recent cuts
right.
in state funding.
Right.
Okay. Right.
So.
Okay.
So do we have bonds expiring within roughly that same time frame?
So the bonds won't expire until 2029, I believe. We've started discussions of what would that look like in terms of if we needed to pass a bond issue, potentially if there is growth. So that we're kind of having that discussion now. We haven't seen that growth materialize yet, and I think COVID kind of created an anomaly year where mm-hmm. you know, we saw a decrease in enrollment this year. And you know, next year, who knows? I mean, I honestly would expect probably a bump well above, you know, even where we were last year, as some of those students potentially come back. But you know, that's, again, that's speculation.
Mm-hmm.
So if I understand, if we were to experience an increase in students, if we put a levy up for a vote fall of 22 to begin being collected in 23, we would have sufficient funds to get us the additional staff or whatever was needed?
I'll say that depends. So if we decided that there's significant enough growth that we need to open a new building, and you know, at some time after that levy, say it's 2024 or 2025, and we wanted to pass a bond issue at the same time as that levy, we would probably have to impact that levy ask, because if you're opening in a new building,
right.
That means new staff. You know, you're going to need a new principal, new classified staff, new certified staff. So that would have a significant impact on the levy ask if we had to open a new building.
A lot can happen over the next couple years. I know.
Yeah.
I know.
As we've said before, school funding is not ever easy.
No.
And it's the complexity of it is always amazed me.
And I just really appreciate your bringing up this idea of using that emergency levy so we can take advantage of the fact that we are so close to the floor. I mean, that's a huge savings, really,
right.
for our community to be able to take advantage of the increase in, potentially take advantage of increase in valuations.
Yep.
So
hopefully this provides some stability.
Right.
Because when you're asking for large millages every 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
You know, that's where you end up, you know.
Get some voter fatigue there. Definitely. And anybody who's working on the campaign fatigue as well. So, yeah. Okay. And I know you had the finance committee meeting, and really there weren't, I don't really recall any too many questions. I think, you know, I think it just made a lot of sense what you're talking about, and just that reality again that we've got a couple of biennial budgets that we really won't know about for a year, and that could potentially, could go either way.
Right.
So we'll just have to
hold tight. And that, you know, your question about the growth,
yeah.
What a funding formula looks like has a huge impact on what growth would it, how it would impact us, because right now if we were on our current formula or lack of formula and we added 1,000 students,
yeah,
it would be zero growth in revenue. You know, we would have to fully fund that with property
right.
taxes, because we would get no additional state funding.
Right. Well, so there was a question brought up about income tax too. So I mean, just so that finance committee, we talked about whether that was something that we would ever want to consider. And there's definitely some pros and positives there as well. So I know that we'll continue to have those conversations and you know, just try and cover all the bases. So next month, this in November, this forecast will be on the on our agenda for approval. So you know, if you're looking this over, you have any more questions, just reach out to Todd and
go from there.
Okay.
Thank you, Todd.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, next on our agenda, we're going to continue our discussion of the appropriate instructional model moving forward. And I think, Diane, you wanted to kind of give us a brief update, and we have some guests here as well. Okay.
Okay, so the purpose in really coming together again was to extend our conversation and really allow you guys to have additional discussion, ask questions, and potentially reach a decision on moving forward. So today I wanted to share with you from last Thursday to today where we are as a district. We did see some increases over the weekend with quarantines and positive cases. So from really Friday until today around noon, I think you'll see this chart represents those changes.
Are those teaching staff?
It's
both.
Staff is on the left, students are on the right of each chart.
Right, I'm saying are the staff teaching staff?
Could be
it's both. Yesterday we pushed out an email to parents, kind of alerting them to a change in our COVID stats. And what that change is, as when a building is coming to a critical staffing limitation, we'll change them to yellow to kind of give parents a heads up that we're having difficulties in that building. In an effort to kind of improve that, so parents, every week I send quarantines for the weekend cumulative, but we're going to try to add the quarantine to this slide.
Mm-hmm.
It still won't give a complete picture because it doesn't speak to, for instance, daily attendance issues or staff members that could be on maternity or paternity leave. So sometimes there are additional staff absences beyond quarantines and COVID. But at least the quarantines will add to that picture beyond my Friday update to families.
I know I got a message last night from a parent who's wondering, you know, how one person testing positive could shut a building down. And when I explained that the quarantine number was larger, they responded, "Oh, that makes perfect sense. I appreciate that." So I think it's important for the community to recognize that the impact is not just on those that have tested positive for the disease, but it's also, as you have with all the charts, the graphs, and seating charts, and so forth, it's all the people that need to quarantine.
Right, and just as a reminder to that, it comes down to two factors, distance and time. So again, it's within 6 feet for 15 minutes or more collective. Not at one moment, but it's collective on that time. So if you have barriers in place, it still doesn't count. It just comes down currently to those two factors of distance and time. So as we think about considerations and going into next school year, last time I shared with you four kind of guiding principles to really, I guess, get your thoughts around and ways to think about kind of a decision-making model moving forward. So how is it that we're making sure that the environment is health and safe for all? How is it that we're looking at social, emotional well-being and all of those pieces as we move forward with whichever motto, instructional level 1 through 4? So we talked a bit about a four-day return. You can just hit all of
okay.
this. And we talked about this was an option that we shared with the task force. And that we could do it with 6 foot social distancing, but there were give to gets with every model. The give to gets with this model in particular at the elementary level is classes would be dispersed. There would be a chance that the teacher that a student has now is not the same teacher they would return with. There would be a chance of a teacher, maybe an art teacher, overseeing a math lesson or maybe Zooming lessons in from another area. Perfect. I'm losing my screen.
There we go.
Are we good?
No.
That one's fine.
Diane?
Yes.
If you have art and phys ed, music teachers that are covering classes for math and reading and so forth, then that would mean that we would not have the music classes, the art classes, is that correct?
Correct. Or they would have to be given, right now we're doing some video options for that, but it would definitely not be to the, when students return, one of our beliefs in talking to principals and teachers, as students will roughly believe they'll have the same experience as a normal year, and that just wouldn't be the case. I think would be the easiest way to say there. It would not be the same kind of experience. Even though the space looks different, we wouldn't be able to offer every single unified art to every student. We may have some aides covering spots, and basically the teacher might zoom in the lesson with the aide facilitating, and then they could switch roles kind of thing. So it would definitely be much more of a disruption to instructional design and classroom setting than students would previously have experienced.
So we could have a classroom of 24 kids, and six of those might be in a room down the hall, and the teachers then splitting time between the two rooms or using video for those six. Okay.
Right.
And they might be lumped together with six from.
I can't give you examples in detail, but that might be an example.
If you have more, kids in a class than you have space for, those beyond the capacity would be someplace else and would receive their instruction
in other ways.
Sure. It could be a Zoom from that regular classroom.
Yeah.
So the instruction would come from the classroom.
Right.
The interaction would probably come from another adult in the building, but there would be the opportunity to switch the roles.
Right. But you could potentially, with that overflow, you might have overflow from three different classes, and they all have a different teacher. So, what I'm saying?
We would look not to do that. The principals think we have spaces in order not to put, for example, first, second, and third grade overflow together.
Yeah. Well, or I was even like at the third grade level, let's say you have three third grade classrooms, and every third grade has some excess in their classrooms, so you may end up with 10 excess together, and each of them coming from a different teacher class, potentially. Okay.
Did you say, Diane, that some of them may even have to change buildings?
My suspicion with that would be if a virtual student, so there are a lot of moving pieces, as we've talked about, so if a virtual academy student would look to return and a building is full, that student may have to go somewhere else. Or if classes were substantially too large for the staff that we might have at that grade level, let's say second grade had way more than second grade could handle at Mill Valley, some of those second graders may shift to Northwood.
Like, what do you think? Like for the remainder of the school year? Like that sort of thing?
That would be my guess. We'd want to limit those kind of transitions
right.
going back and forth, yes.
I mean, I would think at the very least
we try not to do that.
Right.
That would be a last resort right. for coverage.
And it just seems like we've tried to focus on limiting transitions, period, and sticking to trimesters or semesters, if at all possible.
Correct. Yeah. I think the question was just asked of me, could we do it with 6 foot of distance?
Yes.
That is what it would look like with 6 foot of distance.
And it would be in classrooms, not in cafeterias.
It could be. It just depends on each building. Some buildings have more available classrooms than others. We look to use larger spaces, for example, like the music room,
mm-hmm.
so to offset some of that. But it may be a cafeteria. It could be a gym space if we got to that point.
So just to clarify again, it could be a non-classroom space.
Yes. Yep. Well, a non-traditional classroom space, right? Mm. My PE teachers would be upset if they didn't want a classroom space, right? Okay, so one of the questions that came up last time is a serious concern about improving efforts in the hybrid model. So I asked Chris, Ashley, Steve, and Mark to come, and they're going to talk a little bit about the things we have in the works currently to improve hybrid.
Yeah, so when we looked at the data over the summer and from the spring, one of the things that really stood out was we were looking at consistency and really using the grading and progress bars inside of Unified Classroom. And so we really asked our teachers, we asked our principals to really kind of champion that to get the school year started. So that's been the focus. And I think that we've done a really good job with the LMS. Most people are using the LMS class pages. The high school MHS is still using Schoology. And so we're getting that information out there. We're trying to be more consistent with it. It's not perfect, but it's getting a lot better. The grading aspects of the same thing, we're really working towards getting that grading under control. And teachers now across the district are doing standards-based mastery grading, which is great. Okay, so it's the learning curve, but it's getting out there. And we're really now starting to get our parents and our stakeholders to understand how we're looking at grades now. It's not that traditional ABC.
Mm-hmm.
Though it's there at the high school level for 7-12, we still want to look at the standards. And so that's kind of the thing we're working on with our teachers. And it's going along well. They've been working really hard, getting it under control. And I gotta say how nice it's been really seeing the elementaries as a former elementary school teacher, how they've actually got into class pages, used that LMS, and it's been really a blessing for them. And I think most will now say that they really enjoy it and that they will use it going forward, whether we're in a pandemic or not. Okay? And so some of the things we saw now coming back to us in the last survey is some things we need to do better. I mean, now that we've got this up and running, we've got some problems we need to look at and address. The first one is just looking at the accessibility to instruction.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, what we want to maintain is keeping that new targeted standards-based instruction that's going on in person. We want to make sure that's happening. It is happening. We want to continue that and just rebuild on that and expand it. What we need to look at next is really trying to align remote learning tasks, making sure that the instructional activities really are aligning to our mastery expectations, okay? So when kids aren't in the classroom, if they're a remote day, that they're really having that instruction that is going to align to what they've done on the A day if you're a B student and vice versa, the B student on an A day. What has happened, that they're actually looking at that standard-based instruction and they're working through that. To help with that really comes down to looking at regularly posting flexible access to instructional support for students, whether that be a Zoom video that's been recorded, whether that's a video of another teacher recording the standards-based lesson, whether that's just a step guide, or even they do these bit emoji things. Maybe it's something like that where the kids can get on and they can get the access they need to do that lesson. Make sure that we've actually honed in on those needs of our students so it's not something they're trying to dig around for and find, but it's really at their fingertips so they can go in and get that information. The other thing that we've learned and looked at is really how do we increase the frequency of adults' connection to the building. We know that we go 4 days with the 6 feet of social distancing, that we do have adults in the building, so let's get those adults all hands on deck, helping work with kids, maybe small groups with those students, helping them support them as kind of almost like a small group session for students that are remotely learning that need a little extra support when the teacher can't get to them because the teacher's in the class teaching their students that are there for the day. The other thing we looked at was really looking at clear, reasonable remote expectations. That goes back to the LMS. Because it's new, We really want to make sure that students and family understand that. To do that, some of the buildings are actually doing parent nights. They're hosting parent night sessions. They're making sure it's consistent the way they're grading, what they're looking at inside the LMS. We're going to expand some of those opportunities, making sure that parents and students know what they're looking at by providing those parent nights from the buildings, an open house where they can come in and they can look, get online, say, okay, this is how we look, how we use the LMS. A lot of our buildings have already started to do videos that they're saying, as a parent, I can open up this video for my teacher. This is where you find your information. So things like that, so we're more clear and concise. The predictable routines and templates, that's obviously just what it sounds like. I mean, the SOPs are really important. Make sure that you're holding that consistency throughout the day. When I spoke to you guys via video over the summer, we talked a lot about keeping the main thing the main thing. The classroom teacher needs to keep on doing that. We're going to make sure that's happening in the classroom, making sure they have those SOPs in place so that we can clearly communicate the expectations for remote learning responsibilities. That came out clearly on our data that we still don't quite know how to find the progress. So Ashley and I have worked really hard on developing some parent communication. So parents can now go into PowerSchool, they can go to Unified Classroom, they can find out where their progress bars are in there, where the standards are, so they can look and start looking more at the standards-based reporting than just looking at the traditional grade, okay? It's going to be it's obviously a process. It's going to take time because it's new for everyone, new for some of the teachers and new for the parents and some of the students. Academic feedback, that goes back into what I just said, making sure that we have that timely mastery feedback. That goes back into getting our grades in the grade book. Okay, we worked really hard with MHS staff the last 2 months, making sure that they understand how to get their grades in there, and they've done a really good job of jumping in and really getting their grades so parents are able to see them, using consistent coding systems so we're saying, okay, our lesson's going to have a standard in the name so parents know what they're looking for when they go and track down those grades. And then obviously the transparent progress of learning, that goes back to the LMS, that goes back to PowerSchool, making sure they can see that and they're able to understand what they're looking at. And that's going to take time, but we're working on it.
The other things that we're doing is, like Chris insinuated, we're trying to maximize the accessibility to adults when kids are remote so that we ensure a greater sense of connectivity. So a couple of ways we're doing that is we have teachers and specialists who are designing personalized small group Zooms, and so we want to make sure kids are invited to those scheduled Zooms and that it's very targeted on specific learning criteria. To piggyback on that, we got some information from our surveys and our parent feedback that the office hours that teachers were holding were sometimes just open, like, do you have any questions? If you do or you don't, then you can get off the meeting. So we want to make sure that we're setting intentions for the Zoom meetings with teachers, so even if it's a more open feeling, it's targeted toward the learning. Maybe targeted toward a review of instruction from the tier one level. So just working with teams to make sure that it's very purposeful and kids feel the need to get on. We have students who are struggling with engagement in the remote setting, so we're working with teams, and I know at the building level they're creating what I would call success criteria. So what does it take for me, the learner, to be successful when I'm not at school, when I am remote? What does my schedule look like? How do I plan my day? How do I prioritize my time? And I had a conversation with teachers from Bunzl where teams of teachers were working with students on their personal plans and setting goals for being more successful and engaged when they're remote. Mark's going to talk a little bit more about this, but we're going to try to get really intentional using our SEL data to drive some targeted connection with kids with maybe our guidance counselors and other support staff. And we really want to make sure that our adults are connecting with parents so they understand how to help support students. So that might be a linking chart that goes on the refrigerator or a Zoom session with a reading specialist on how to reinforce reading instruction. Things like that that help parents continue to partner with us and feel equipped to do so. And our leadership teams are working together to create audits to help get evidence of what's working and what's not and generate feedback to teachers to reinforce what's really going well and to help refine what we need to continue improving. So they're running instructional audits that are aligning to our continuum and our habits of mind that we've been working on for 4 years. Principals are working hard to ensure consistency, like Chris said, keeping the main thing, and making sure that our tools are purposeful and supporting the instructional goals, and not just maybe fun and new and exciting, but really honed in on what the goals are. Clear and consistent communication continues to be a goal with our leadership teams, and then making sure that we're bringing students to the table to allow their voices to be heard in what's working and what's not working in our hybrid model. So that's just an overview of some things we're working on for more clear and consistent connectivity.
We know even if we bring K-4 back, that we're going to still have remote learning going on.
Right.
So we wanted to make sure that we communicated to you what that might look like. Okay. We also had some questions about what kind of services may we look for to support families. So Mark's made some connections with community partners.
I'd be happy to speak on that. So in order to make some qualitative improvements and enhancements to the support structures we already have in place, some of these things have already been in progress, but we'll be bringing those to life over the really this week and next week. One of them is no-cost tutoring available to kids and families through the HOPE Center. That's actually a state-funded project. We have all of the tutors lined up. We're in the process of bringing in a number of high school students to receive service hours to also assist with that tutoring. It will cover an array of K-12 content offerings that will be available after school. And we are in the process of finalizing how the sign-up process for families will look. So I should actually have something this week where families will begin to be able to sign up to get on board with the tutoring. And it's at no cost to families. Yes, yeah, no cost to families for that tutoring service.
So is it going to be during the day also?
As of right now, due to staff availability, so our staff are helping to man that operation, it is occurring outside of school hours at the moment.
Is there any plan to try and extend that?
That would be up to Becky Polk, the CEO of the HOPE Center.
Okay.
I can only speak to our personnel and what services we're going to be able to partner with them on in order to provide those services.
Gotcha.
In terms of additional mental health supports, we've wrapped a three-way graded funding project between us, the Mental Health Recovery Board, and Mary Haven to onboard a third school navigator, a school-based mental health provider. That person, from what I understand, has been selected, and they are going through the background check process at this time. So roughly within 2 weeks, I will have a third mental health provider for the school district. And those folks, they partake in a no-cost screening and referral process. So if families, you know, have youth that they are concerned about, I strongly recommend that they contact their school building or their school counselor in order to get that screening taken care of and to initiate that entire process. And again, that's at no cost to families there. And that allows them to liaison not just with Mary Haven, which is where most of our providers come from, but they actually work as coordinators for other services within the area. So they have touch points with social services like Job and Family Services, Ohio Guidestones, another mental health provider in town. They work with private providers. So it's not solely based on, hey, you have to go to Mary Haven and use the service. They actually coordinate and liaison with an array of services in Union County. Something that we're in the process of organizing is Red Cross babysitter basic training. This is a four-hour class that's done through online modules. It's for kids age 11 and older. There is a cost associated with that class, but I'm in the process of working with community partners to look at offsetting or absorbing those costs for families so they'll be able to get their youth trained in best practices for babysitting. So like being safe at homes, safe medication management, how to handle infants, things like that. And then last but not least, just like Ashley had mentioned, we're in the process of looking at how we can target and onboard and support students that are at risk socially and emotionally. So in K-6, we'll start that process through the use of our social-emotional skill data that we have, and then we'll be scaling that up into 7 through 12. So we have inroads to begin that work through like course failures and things like that, but we will be doing risk screening in the 7 through 12 population probably in November of this year. So we'll be able to also, again, onboard that process in the same manner we have in K-6.
All right, so the other return we talked about last time was really the same kind of tiered return, starting with K-4, but for foregoing that 6 feet of distance. We talked quite a bit about the give to gets in that model, and talked quite a bit about the increased numbers of quarantines or the possibility or potential for that. We also know from looking at other districts, like we talked about, who have started in a K-12 model, that the lowest incidence seems to be still in that K-4 range in mm-hmm. that model. So in this model, it would be more of what I think we would think students would assume would mm-hmm. happen when they would come back to school. And as we talk about quarantines, that we do think that this would be have the highest potential to move us back to a remote platform, mm-hmm. just by doing some predictive modeling around the number of quarantines that we've seen in classes. So, mm-hmm. but it certainly would create the more typical school experience or atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. So, Excuse me. Just, I think to be clear, if we were to make a decision to go back to 4 days a week in class, either with 6 feet or without 6 feet, if we have quarantining and we need to take a step back, the step would not be back to hybrid. The step would be back to remote. Okay.
Again, we talked about this last meeting, just right. as a review. We know there's not a perfect situation. We have the hybrid model that we're currently in that has give to gets the two transitioning models, one with 6 feet of distance and one without, entering flu season. We also know holiday season. We also know that the state in Central Ohio and our county are seeing increased numbers, and I understand that was consistent today in the governor's update. I was not able to watch that. And in general, we've talked, even as staff, on my Zoom sessions today about just needing to stay the course with wearing our masks and making sure that even between one another, as colleagues, we were keeping 6 feet of distance and et cetera, so that we weren't starting to lax on some of those safety protocols that have benefited the district to date. So one of the things that I wanted to bring forward tonight, and I asked for Mark's help in this work, was that I thought that at our last meeting, I really heard from all of you an interest in community spread and where we stood as a community and community responsibility. And I have been pushing really probably since we've started school to really understand solid metrics that would indicate a healthier community in the middle of a pandemic. And in general, one of the big numbers, even through CDC and Franklin County came out and made a statement last week, I believe it was, is really cases per 100,000. And that's kind of hard to actualize, I think, or operationalize as a school district. And the number that we read about quite often is that indicator of a healthier community is less than 50 new cases per 100,000 in a two-week time frame. So I asked Mark, I'll have you come up again, to kind of help me make sense of what that was when you thought about Union County, when you think about the townships that impact or the boundaries of our school district, and then what that means as a school, in order to kind of give you guys some ideas of some metrics we may look at to kind of use as decision making as well.
Sure. So like Diane had mentioned, we wanted to articulate a mechanism or a series of mechanisms through which we could compare our county level data to our school district boundary data, which again is not perfect. It is the closest approximation we could attain, and that's through our townships. Mm-hmm. This data project, if you will, was done in conjunction with our local Department of Health, so they were the ones that really provided the data. The townships that we cover included Allen, Dover, Leesburg, Liberty, Paris, and Taylor, so there is some mm-hmm. overlap with with Fairbanks and North mm-hmm. Union, but by and large, that drastically makes up the vast majority of Marysville schools. But having that district boundary comparison to county level comparison, and then on a subsequent slide, I also have, which don't change it yet, thank you. I also have student data, and I'll articulate why they're not all on the same chart. But this has all been scaled down to X number of cases in a two-week window of time per 1,000 individuals. In this case, it's adults. On my next slide, it's students, because that is a much more easily palatable metric for us than per 100,000. There's 58,000 people living in Union County, yet we use the 100,000 criteria, right? So for a school system, it's very appropriate for us to use a rate per 1,000. What else are we? We can go to the student slide.
Before you do that,
yes.
When you explain the slide, can you tell us what the lines are and what the...
Thank you.
I can't see it.
Right.
So the red line is our township data. That is our approximate school district boundary case rate per 1,000 adults. Okay. And I have it tiered out. It's very hard to see the colors because they're faded or slightly transparent. At the very, very bottom, you'll see from 0 to 0.5, kind of a block. You'll see a dotted line there. That is the low community spread indicator, if you will. Okay.
So anything below that dotted line.
Yes, that would be low community spread. That means we have less than 0.5 cases per 1,000 individuals, right? You can't really have half a person, but for our comparison purposes, that's the metric we set. And then on the high spread indicator, which is the very top dashed line, that is 1 per 1,000 adults, which would correspond with the 100 per 100,000 individual case rate. So red is our district boundary township data, with the very dark gray, nearly black line corresponding with the Union County data as well. So, you know, one thing that, like Dinah articulated, we're very interested in the community level spread, so I wanted to get that up on there. Did the exact same thing for our students. Now you're probably going, well, why aren't the students alongside everything else? Well, because those are different populations, right? The only way I could compare what's happening within the walls of the school to what's going on with the boundaries of the school is if we incorporated all data for all individuals of all ages within the school system. That would include teaching staff and non-teaching staff that are also positive within the walls of the school. The way that data is currently recorded, it doesn't precisely match the CDC and Ohio Department of Health reporting criteria, where you've had an onset of symptoms within the last 2 weeks. So we know when a case was positive, but we don't know necessarily always when an onset of symptoms occurred in the precise date, which is how we land in our reporting windows for those 2 week windows of time. But the indicators that 0 to 0.5 per thousand, you know, 1 per thousand and higher, still corresponds on a low, moderate, and high spread scale, even for our students. So this is our current student population. The data is relevant as of last week. You'll know that the 11th, the reported one for October 11th is missing. It's because we didn't have any students with positive cases with an onset of symptoms that fell within that window. And again, that's consistent with the Ohio Department of Health and CDC criteria. That's how we report data here at the county level. Yes.
Is that new cases over the last week or new cases over the last 2 weeks?
2 weeks. So it's a two-week rolling window is how it would happen like that, because it's roughly 14 days for onset of symptoms. Yes. So I've got to get my cheat sheets out here. Really, that is it. So that kind of gives you a gauge on where we're at in terms of student body spread, community level spread. If you could go back. Our community level spread relative to how we are doing as a county right now.
So what are the actual numbers are the red line? Clearly the red line, Marysville is much higher than the rest of the county.
Correct.
So what are the numbers represented there?
So like, for example, if I look at October 4th for the county, we're just over, I don't know the precise value, right? 1.1 something, 1.2 something per 1,000 cases at the county level. So that scale overall the right corresponds with that rate of per 1,000 cases.
And Mike, what's at the very top there, the highest number?
Oh,
is that like
that's
two?
That's 2 per 1,000.
Gotcha.
Cases. And it's actually, so the it's not quite 2, mm-hmm. It's like 1.9.
Okay.
At its peak for the week of September 27th in those townships.
Okay.
And this is just diagnosed cases?
These are cases that have been confirmed with an onset of symptoms that fall within those date ranges within a two-week period of time.
And that's all ages, correct?
This is all ages data, correct. Yeah, it is all ages. And then the next slide has been disaggregated by school-age students.
That's all students, K through 12?
K through 12, correct.
Okay.
Total numbers are very low, correct?
But they're per, well, not necessarily, because it's scaled per 1,000, not per 100,000. So even one case per 1,000 students is a high rate of spread when it's scaled up to 100 per 100,000 students. Okay. So
that risk level is designated by the CDC. So that is an R designation.
Correct. It's just scaled down to a more relatable rate per 1,000 individuals. So yeah, so even, like I said, one case per 1,000 students would be considered high spread based upon the CDC criteria. That's also consistent with the Ohio Department of Health's community advisory system, a public health advisory system that they utilize. So for example, the week of September 27th, we were sitting at a 1.9 per 1,000 case rate in that two-week window of time.
Because again, the CDC guideline is they prefer, or they say it's good to be under 50 per 100,000.
Correct. Which in our scale purpose would be 0.5.
Okay. Because it just indicates the level of spread that's happening in a community.
But I understand these are metrics coming from various health departments, but we are in a little bit of an awkward position because we have 58,000 people in Union County. So even one or two cases can trigger some of these alerts because our overall numbers are low.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of to your point, the total number of cases in Union County has never been a super high number.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to explain to the community why one sick staff member at Northwood puts us in yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And why two people being diagnosed,
right,
perhaps without any symptoms, okay, now says we have to keep the school shut down. So literally hundreds of emails now that we have gone through that day.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't include quarantines, correct?
No.
Right.
This is just positive cases. Quarantines are the reason why Northwood number.
But I think it's leading to the level of hostility we're seeing in the communication to us.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one person is sick and it's making such a drastic impact on the community.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it flows straight out of the arithmetic because we just have 58,000 people here. Not even that many if you go down into the townships.
Correct.
So it is a little bit odd. And I don't feel hostile towards it, but I do feel that we need to take into account that that's what we're talking about. I mean, kind of one or two cases.
But that's per thousand. Mm-hmm. Now you got 58,000, so multiply that. That's
even one case or two, what would it be? How many cases in a week would trigger us, put us into that high category? Not that many.
Well, it's one to two per 58,000.
The number you said was 50 new cases per 100,000, which is, if you divide by 100, 0.5 per 1,000. And how many people do we have in the
township? It'd be like a half a case per 1,000 would be the same as 50 cases per 100,000.
So to trigger that high spread indicator in Marysville schools with approximately a population of 5,200 students, it changes. We're usually about 5,200. At that rate of one per 1,000, five, comes up to five and a fifth of a person It's 5.2. It's really five individuals or five students would trigger that
over a week or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Over 2 weeks.
Now,
five student cases in 2 weeks.
But that doesn't count all the quarantines that are going to be tested.
I'm talking about diagnosed cases.
Okay.
If I can interject, one of the reasons for trying to determine this and the goal of the CDC is to stop the spread.
Right.
And if you have five cases and the quarantine is used as a barrier to try to stop the spread of the disease, and so if we have five cases and we quarantine 10 people or 15 people for each one of those five cases, we get a significant number of people. And if we dismiss that and say that that's not significant, then we, at least in my mind, we run the risk of providing the opportunity for additional spread above and beyond. The idea that the CDC and from what I've read and heard, what they're trying to do is to clamp down on this thing and try to make sure that people in the community are not passing it from one person to another. And that takes what I would consider, and what I think everyone else here, it takes drastic action to be able to do that. So we may be talking about small numbers, but the guidance that the CDC and other health agencies that are involved in community health are saying, these are significant numbers and these are significant infection rates.
Right.
And I have a hard time, and I understand, you know, five.
I know, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
The point is that I don't think the majority of the community understands the impact of quarantine. By the tone of the emails that we have been receiving, okay, they do not understand, and they look at our information that the district is sharing, and it just makes them upset because they're only seeing one case here, one case there, and then they are being subjected to hybrid schooling or online schooling. So I don't think that we have done a good enough job explaining to the community that it's not just the number, it's the quarantine, the required quarantine that goes with it, which impacts potentially dozens of students, possibly with each impact, with each diagnosed case.
And then they have to realize that once they're quarantined, the parents get quarantined, and that keeps spreading. It goes from 10 days to 2 weeks to 21 days when all these kids, you know.
And it can happen multiple times.
Like that.
I know. Yeah, well, and that's why I'm glad that you're working to include quarantine numbers on that slide, you know, because the numbers are little, but it's really talking about the exponential impact of one case and, you know, how it could end up impacting so many people.
Well, and Diane showed that
in
our last layout,
you know, like
how where the kids are seated and where they're not and where the impact is.
Right.
I just don't think that people are taking the time to educate themselves on it. I think the information is out there. I think people are frustrated. I mean, we're all fatigued by it.
Right.
But I think that they are not taking the time, and they just want to put a blame somewhere where there's nowhere to blame for this pandemic. I mean, in our local area here, and so they need to really sit down and absorb what that means as far as the quarantines and how it's going to affect their family. Because if they feel their family's affected now with hybrid, what happens when you have to go in quarantine your entire family for 30 days? And you can't go to work, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. You know, you talk about struggling. The struggle hasn't even started till that happens. So I think we have to look at that, and hopefully they will, you know, people will start educating themselves on how this thing goes from 0 to 100 very quick.
Well, and we saw, we received that email from an administrator in a nearby district who talked about starting the school year hybrid, only having one incident. They said they were going to reassess in 4 weeks, having one incident, and then making a decision to come back 4 days a week. And after 3 weeks, quote unquote, they had an explosion of like 23 cases, which resulted in over 200 quarantines, a building being switched to remote. I went to their website today, and there was a letter dated yesterday about their high school, and they said, we had 5 cases at the high school, so we're going remote this week so they could do the contact tracing, and they'll let them know what's going to happen, you know. So that's a reality. And I know there are some districts that have come back and they haven't had that experience, you know. But if you look at all of the data that we have for our community, because that's what we've said all along, we're going to base this on what's happening in our community and what we feel comfortable with for our staff and our students and families, you know, we are experiencing higher levels of spread than surrounding areas. And, you know, I like our Union County Health Departments. They have some maps that show Paris Township is the highest area, and then, you know, the data that you shared here tonight just confirms those things. So you know, I listen to a lot of the things that are in the works now. I appreciate how we've surveyed our parents and our staff, and we're really trying to personalize our response. You know, I'm listening to this thinking, well, even if we weren't in a pandemic, we'd be doing the exact same things that we're doing now. We'd be looking at what's happening in the classrooms, and, you know, there would be some kids in the classroom, even if they came in 5 days a week, that would be struggling with something. So how are we going to address that? There are some kids that are thriving in the remote setting, and there are other kids who are struggling, exactly the same as kids in the classroom. So I love some of the things that you've got planned, and I appreciate how, you know, we're really going to try and minimize the negative side of this instructional setting. And I just feel like our, you know, what we've done in the hybrid has allowed the most students possible to have face-to-face instruction with teachers, see some of their student, you know, classmates, and you know, I think they will grow from this, learning how to take charge of their education. And I heard them, you know, talking about having meetings at Bunsell where the students were setting their goals and talking about things that they could do to improve the remote learning experience. So, you know, I mean, I feel very comfortable with our hybrid option right now, and I, especially knowing the things that we're doing to help address some of the concerns that we've been hearing.
Well, can I say something about that?
Sure.
I actually wanted to say this back when you were presenting. You may not be privy to all the communications that we're getting. You may be getting much more than we are. But one of the things we're definitely hearing is parents struggling with how to help their kids at home. And they're, sometimes it's with the technology, but sometimes it's with the content. So you mentioned a couple things to help parents, and that could be one of the biggest things that we do as a district to get through this, is to really think, how can we help these parents, especially the parents of the elementary kids?
Mm-hmm.
How can we give them tools, almost like we give our teachers tools, you know, mm-hmm. like how can we support them,
mm-hmm.
so they don't just feel like they're floundering. I'm not even talking about missing work or all those challenges or trying to work remotely while their kids are over here. Just the basics of how does a parent who's not trained in education handle this when their kid is coming to them in the middle of the day because of a question about content or about technology. So that's just one piece of this, but it's a huge piece, more than we can do to figure out ways to support these parents, whether they're on quarantine or they've picked the virtual academy or whatever, or it's that fifth day of the week, you know. That's what we're hearing a lot from these parents. Not only that they want to go back, but that they're having trouble handling it. Does anybody want to say anything to that?
I think one of the things that which we kind of touched on is, and I know a lot of us are videoed out and all of that, but getting our teachers to create a short 2-minute, 3-minute snippet of a video that it can go home on the LMS where the student can pull that up, so the parent can actually view that and say, okay, this is how the teacher teaches this. Whether it's from that teacher, maybe it's something they got off the internet on YouTube that they watched someone else do, or maybe it's another teacher in the building even that teaches that lesson, obviously standard-based design for our continuum, and that we can share those resources. And the LMS we have allows for that collaboration, that shareability, that we can put those things up there where teachers can grab. I even mentioned today on a principal call when we were talking about this that we can even do that for our students. We can create a class page that all students are on where they can go in. Now, this would be more for the upper levels where they have more ability to go find that stuff. Mm-hmm. But a classroom teacher could, if there's a lesson that's home for that remote day, make sure they are attaching those videos and those extra resources. And we talk about the flexibility part of it, and not just the video, but also something else that may be a step guide to help them walk through. We hear that from our teachers all the time. They like the videos, but sometimes they like the step guides too. And so getting that, you know, that feedback, and it's hard because we are remote and there's not a whole lot we can do during those days, but we can do better for sure. Mm-hmm. We can give more resources and give more opportunities.
One of the things that I'm learning in the virtual space, so I'm running the all K-4 virtual academy. We're right to the point now, I would say, you know, parent-teacher conferences and getting a body of work with student samples, teacher observations, small groups. We're to the point now where we're truly identifying, you know, in a typical school year, we identify, like Sue said, the kids that are struggling in a 5-day-a-week normal school year. You know, that happens and you really hit your stride right around Thanksgiving time. That's the natural heartbeat of the school year. We're now identifying the people that you're talking about and having those conversations so that we can put Plan Bs in place. We can put Tier 2 interventions in place, not just for the student, but now the entire family. So, you know, we're coming up upon that for a number of reasons, and the parent-teacher conferences that have gone on really helped us to hone in and say, here's our short list of families that need additional Tier 2 support. So they're not struggling.
I think that's huge, because it's not just whether the parent can do it. Mm-hmm. It's whether they feel like they're part of a team, that they know that you're listening.
When students get frustrated, the parent says it differently than the student, or than the teacher.
Yeah.
And so just providing that consistency, we say consistency, but I have a third grader, and he wants me to say it like a teacher says it. Well, if I have a video for doing that helps me, you know, parent-teacher better. So that's certainly another benefit of what Chris is talking about, where you have short videos just to provide that. Yes, I know how to do your math problem, but it's going to be taught to you in this way, so let me complement that.
Mm-hmm. I really like hearing, like with the parent-teacher conferences, just reinforcing this idea that it is a partnership, you know, that there's always been an expectation that parents are a part of their child's education. But right now, obviously, there's a lot more being asked of these parents than they've been used to having to take care of, Just helping to support them and giving them as many tools as possible, it is a partnership. So kind of reminding them, yeah, this is not what you're used to, and hopefully you won't have to be as involved. But it's not all bad to learn a little bit more about the realities of the classroom and what our teachers deal with, you know, on a daily basis. So
one of the things that I think is true is that if you face constant change, then it's difficult to address the problems because the problems constantly change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're starting to get a handle and a real picture of where the problems are, where the issues are with this hybrid system. And I know when the teacher representatives came and talked to us last Thursday, at the heart of their message was consistency. That they were meeting consistently 2 days a week with the kids that they had, and that they were able to spend good quality time as they had smaller groups of kids with each one of those students, which they felt like their observation, their anecdotal response was that then on the remote days, the students are more effective because we're able to do a better job. And in the emails, as I've read them, I think consistency and problem solving have been consistent themes. I've been frustrated. I've said before, I know some of the emails, they've called us various names and so forth. I've told people that my wife and my sister have called me worse, so that's okay.
Is that a comment on your marriage?
That could be. Could be. We did celebrate 51 years.
Oh, wow. Woo-hoo. So,
anyway, I know that consistency, maintaining a course, allows you then to address the issues and problems. Mm-hmm. And I think that the hybrid system gives us the best opportunity at this point to stay consistent. I think if we move from that to greater in-person instruction, we open the gate for greater quarantine possibilities. And I can't think of anything more disruptive than a parent finding out that suddenly they've got kids at home for the next 10 days of school, throw out the weekends and so forth. And that there's not going to be a teacher at all for at least four of those days. For the students, I think it's the same thing. I think they would miss that. Now, I had said earlier in some meetings that we had, you know, there was a window of opportunity for us maybe to make a change and to make a move. But having said that 2-3 weeks ago, in that length of time, as the numbers indicate, as the governor talks about it, as the county health director has said, things are kind of moving in the wrong direction. At one point I wanted to make tonight, we had a person come and address us last week, and they said, you know, North End is going back, Fairbanks is going back. The health director said those two school districts are not comparable to us. Mm-hmm. That their circumstances, their situations are entirely different. And they said, you know, Dublin is considering going back full time. Applying this model, the numbers and so forth, to what Dublin has on their website in terms of their rubric in some place, they would be in a hybrid system. They would not be in full 5 days a week or 4 days a week in-person instruction. And I don't know what, you know, decisions or situation they're in, but I know if we take our numbers for our district, use the Dublin City Schools decision-making model, we would be in a hybrid situation.
Well, here's the point I think I made it the last meeting, and I think it needs to be made again and kept in our heads, which is at some level it doesn't matter what's going on in the county if the schools are not spreading it. Okay, so we can't simply say, oh, Union County is red, the schools close down, because that's a big presumption that the schools are contributing to that spread, and we still don't know that. I brought it up with the health director, and it could also be different between the age groups. Mm-hmm. Are you following me? If the schools are safe, either because of the procedures that we have or because of the ages of the kids or any number of things, then it actually might help the community when we get into the red if the kids are in school. And I don't want to forget that possibility. I don't want to come up with a model where we're just like slavishly tied to the numbers in the county unless we find out through either our own numbers or somebody else's that the schools are spreading it.
Then how do we keep the kids from bringing it into the schools when they're out going to restaurants with their parents, going to functions, birthday parties, overnights, blah, blah, blah. They're contacting it, their family's contacting it, they're bringing it back to the schools, to the teachers, to the rest of the students. How do we stop that?
Well, I don't know, but I'm thinking...
Keep the 6 feet distance and less than 15
yeah.
minutes, you know?
Right. I mean, so, you know, so I think it has to be... I personally feel the hybrid model is working as well, and I think that you guys are doing a great job in tweaking that and seeing all the situations now that are coming up, as you said, Steve, you know, coming up Thanksgiving, we know that this is the time where you start targeting all the areas, what we need, what the kids need, and not putting it on to the students, because you know they're going to go with their parents to these functions and this and that. They're going to come into school like it's normal if we go back to a 4-day-a-week model and there's no distancing. So unless the entire community is on board of saying, okay, we're not going to take these kids to functions, we're not going to take them to parties, we're not going to do this, we're not going to expose our children out there, we're not going to expose our family. Now, if we had every commitment to that, then I think we're okay to go back. But we're never going to get that.
Right.
We're never going to get it, because our children are ultimately going to be the ones that are thrown into this big... Since we've got consistency going, as Dick was saying, the consistency in their life matters. If all of a sudden, now we decide to go to a 4-day when we're in a red zone, that consistency goes away totally, and we go to full remote, how do we keep them engaged at all?
But let me go back to my point. What we were told last week, and correct me if I got this wrong, none of the cases are being transmitted in the schools. Because you have a student who is positive doesn't mean that he or she picked it up in the school.
Correct.
So if the kid is sick, but the kid has it, obviously, and they know they have it, they should stay out of school. But if they have it and they don't, and they go to school, they may not pass it to anybody.
But you got an email like I did. We all got one email that said a mother said, oh, it's just allergies. Sent her child to school.
Well,
you see what I mean? So, you know, when we go back to that 4-day model.
I'm acknowledging that there'll be some kids that show up at school that actually have it and either don't know it or they're just.
Right.
Right. About it. But,
right.
But the most important question is it being transmitted between kids or between kids and adults in the buildings? And so far we don't know that, correct?
Correct.
So
we have not had positive cases linked together mm-hmm. in our current format.
So I'm open to going towards, let's say, a 4-day, like your tiered plan is pretty moderate. It's not like we're going back tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's only that one age group that's only in November. So that's, to me, that's being pretty cautious and careful, right? And that's the age group that's the least likely to be passing it, you know, because of at least what the data seems to show so far. I'm not talking about who gets symptoms. I'm talking about who is transmitting it.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be a difference by age for that. So I don't want to do anything that puts our teachers at risk. If we knew that like little kids were passing it to adults like teachers, then that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But so far it doesn't look like that's the main way it's being transmitted. It's being transmitted outside of the school building.
Right, but if it's outside, it eventually has to come in if you're putting people less than 6 feet and the time and distance if we're not paying attention to.
What I'm saying, Amy, is that's not happening.
Well, no, because we haven't done it yet.
Well, what's part of what we're going to talk about, right? If we go back, if some of the buildings go back, let's say the elementaries in November, will they keep the 6 feet or not?
And I would say, you know, after reviewing all of the data and looking at things and just the reality of going back 4 days with the 6-foot social distancing and all of the challenges that would put on staff and maybe building changes, different teachers, all that kind of stuff, I was kind of thinking about HGTV shows when they do House Hunters or something, you know, and you've got three options. I would put the X on the 4 days with 6-foot social distancing, because I think that would just be too dramatic of a change in how we provide instruction. But then at the same time, you know, to go back without the 6-foot social distancing, and I know at the elementaries, they may not always be able to keep that 6-foot social distancing with, you know, teachers helping students, but I think if you intentionally go back without that 6-foot social distancing, you're just asking for way too many quarantines. You know, because it's because those are the two factors, 6 feet and 15 minutes. And so one student comes in with a positive case and it could be the whole class along with the teacher. And now we're talking about staffing issues, and we know we're already at a breaking point. Just like every year we struggle this time of year between flu and other things. And, you know, I've gone into buildings and they said, oh, this teacher had to call in sick because her kids were sick. And so now we're splitting her class. You know, well, I don't know if we can do that this year.
So one thing that stands out to me right now is, first of all, we've been on hybrid and we weren't at a red. Mm-hmm. Now we're at a red and we're talking about starting this up in November. That yeah. doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
That doesn't Neither. Follow the guidelines. So if we weren't doing 4 days a week when we were yellow, why mm-hmm. would we do 4 days a week when we're red?
Right.
First of all, I think we have to move past where we're at right now to see. I mean, I have no problem with a tiered plan. I don't mm-hmm. like it right now. I think that you've got holidays coming up. You know everybody's going to be together. Families are going to be together. There's going to have, all of this is going to go on. So I think taking away this hybrid model right now is a mistake. And getting through November and December with a hybrid model, I think makes sense because everybody's going to be with their families over Thanksgiving, over Christmas. Extended families are going to be together. So I'm not sure why we would even contemplate when we're in a red zone mm. to put kids back in.
Right. Well, I'll tell you why, and I don't want this to sound crazy or good. It may be putting the kids back in school 4 days a week actually slows it down. See, I feel like we're operating under this presumption that the schools are places where it spreads. We don't actually know that. It might be better for the kids to be in school because when they're not in school, they're, you know, hanging out with friends or whatever.
Right. So
that's why I say we have to keep in mind the possibility that the schools are not part of what's putting Union County into the red.
I was not trying to interrupt you. I'm sorry. What you have said is one of the things that I was thinking in looking at, we have maybe a window of opportunity. Mm-hmm. But as the discussion went on, and as we were presented with what it takes, because I think we have to, the doctor and the nurse in my family, you know, have said this is real. And one of the things that bothers me is emails that say that there's no truth to the virus and so forth. That there are too many people that have been sick. There's too many people that have suffered. Too many people have died. It is real. And I was looking for a way that we could make a move to getting the kids back more in class. But to maintain 6 feet, we really have to create an almost Alice in Wonderland mm-hmm. system. But then, particularly the elementary, where we have kids that are assigned to this room, actually, in a different room, and we have a teacher that is trying to be two places at one time, we lose art, we lose music, we lose physical education, we lose any of those enrichment things, which, to me, are essential to the social-emotional health of the kids. Being able to paint or to color, to be able to sing as an outlet for the frustrations, concerns, a way of them, you know, being creative and putting emotion into other kinds of things. And so to lose all of that in order to have reading and math and so forth, meaning math, really, I'm not downplaying those by any means, but I think, you know, I think it's important for kids to get physical education. I think it's important for them to be able to sing and dance and things they do in music and art, be able to be creative. And I think the greatest opportunity for that to happen, and it's not at all perfect, it's not what I would like for the situation to be, but I think the hybrid system, the way we have, even down to kindergarten and first grade, with all of the struggles and problems that presents us, is the most beneficial way for us to proceed at this point. And I share the concern that we've got the holiday season coming up. Mm-hmm. The health director said our county has had a spike after every holiday. Mm-hmm. I would attribute that to the social gatherings and family mm-hmm. gatherings and so forth. And the flu season really poses another unknown for us that was not a positive unknown coming into this. Mm-hmm. So the point you've made, you know, it is part of what I've done in terms of thinking through things. So it's not, I mean, if I said something that made it sound dismissive or whatever, please, that's not the case. Because what you said was exactly what I was thinking in terms of us being able to actually get kids back here.
Well, I feel very similar to what Sue was saying a minute ago, that the going back with putting everybody back and keeping them 6 feet apart sounds not very appealing. So mm-hmm. when I was saying that I thought this tiered approach was moderate and, you know, a serious plan, I was picturing that they would be going back into their regular educational settings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like you're very concerned about that being 3 feet apart or whatever it would be, there's going to be too many quarantines, there's going to be all sorts of disruption coming
out
of
that. I think the goal of the parents is try to get the kids back in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And I think if we bring the kids back and we don't maintain 6 feet mask and hand washing and all the other things, that we will actually end up with the kids at home more.
Mm-hmm.
At least there's the potential for that. And I know that's something that people out there listening to this or watching this or whatever, it may be something that they haven't thought about, but we have, I think, a small example, a good example of one case that is having a significant impact on one of our elementary buildings. And if you multiply that a couple of times, mm-hmm. It really puts you know, quite a large number of kids at risk. The last thing kind of on this I want to mention was the fact that we've all said that we're in this together.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that we need the support of the parents, we need the support of the kids, we need the support of the teachers and the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And the information we have is that teachers are concerned for themselves, and we heard, I think, last week that they were also concerned for their students. Mm-hmm. And that those two concerns, their own personal health and how it would impact their families, and also their concern for the impact that changes would have on the students, the quality of the instruction and so forth that they would get, I think we need to be cognizant of.
Mm-hmm.
If we're all in this together, it's got to be everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, just a couple points I want to make. First of all, the American Academy of Pediatrics has made it very, very clear that they would like to see kids back in the schools. And I think that reflects a lot of the correspondence we've had primarily to the case that many kids cannot thrive on a remote learning situation. With that being said, the governor today announced that we had 2,015 new cases in Ohio, an all-time record today. We have 216 new hospitalizations. We have 1,221 people hospitalized. And we've got 161 people on ventilators, and 69 out of 88 counties are in the high level. So this is probably not the time. So I searched the internet for a case study that was similar to our situation. I found a school district just north of Salt Lake City. In mid-September, they returned to full in-person school. At the time, their rate was 187 per 100,000, which is kind of close to where we are right now. Very quickly, they moved to a rate of 617 per 100,000 with many people hospitalized. 30 days into the school year, they had 77 cases in the school, resulting in hundreds of quarantines, and the whole district was put on remote learning. Similar district, similar rate. They weren't quite as precautious as what we are doing, but I'm afraid with entering flu season, our result may be similar.
Diane, do you have any comments, or what's your thought? I mean, you talk to our staff. You do Zoom meetings with the buildings. Do you have a sense?
Right. I think there's a lot of angst K for both directions. There's angst to come back with 6 feet of distancing. They think that's not right by kids. But there's angst in their own mind around safety precautions when we're less than 3 feet. I mean, I think that's been came through in the survey as well. I think it's a tough decision. Consistency is something that we want to maintain, and we've tried to focus on. And I think when it comes down to evaluating the models and consistency, has to play an important be an important decision making piece in that, and which model may, again, we don't have a crystal ball in order to make that prediction. I do have one thing to consider. Could you move forward one more slide? One of the things we talked about, so once we decide on an instructional model, this was something that I've been pushing for since early in the school year. I think I've talked more than once about Central Ohio districts are a part of Ohio State Project, and that project reports to them as a community. Basically, that's what Mark and I tried to, Mark did the work, I talked conceptually. He makes it come alive. But, and Dublin's a part of that project, so when you saw their criteria, that's generated from that. So I wonder if, and this might not be the end result, but I thought I would start something in which we could wrap our minds around to say, okay, look, we'll come back 4 days a week in the tiered model, if we're not red. If we can reach that low range, low spread range, I think is the correct verbiage, right, Mark, in the equation. You know, if we can get out of the high through the moderate into that low range for students in our community, that is the best practice. That means that 50 new cases per 100K, that is set forth by the CDC. So that seems to make sense to me. I'm thankful that Mark can make that magic happen. But
you know, looking at something that that would clearly define for us the goal that we're looking to meet.
Right.
And I'm not saying this has to be the final,
yeah,
but it seemed to make sense to be the indicator to get us to that low range, right, as well as maybe quantifying. We don't want to attach ourselves directly to that level, and I've said that from the get-go,
right,
and I know Brian said a little bit ago.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to say, if we're yellow, we're this, if we're orange, we're this.
Right.
But saying, hey, if we're red or purple,
yeah,
you know, we're not going to be able to go to 5 days or 4 days or whatever,
mm-hmm,
it might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good start. And
I do too.
You know, we can't ignore the data that's out there, you know, so.
Now, the you said something about blame, and I don't want to blame anybody, Amy, but I do want to foster a sense of collaboration and
mm-hmm.
teamwork and community, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is Union County, and we're all in it together, and
mm-hmm.
there are actually things we can do, whether you're a parent or not.
Yes.
Right.
To stay out of the red, because we know a lot more than we knew in
absolutely.
March. Okay?
Absolutely.
We know that masks help. We know that keeping some distance helps. We know not going into a gathering where people are close together for a long period of time. We know a lot.
Right.
If we just have to do it,
mm-hmm.
we all have to do it.
Right.
And
absolutely.
It's hard.
It
I
is.
Want to be with my family.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I would like us to do whatever we can to foster the sense that it's not all down to the administrators or the school board in terms of moving forward.
That's our whole community.
The county needs to get together on this, and I don't see it right now. I see a lot of people just kind of, some people, like you said, are paying attention, and maybe not everybody is.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, it's our school district. If you watch the breakout map of where the
right.
incidences are, it is in our school district. It's not in neighboring school districts.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right that it's a community issue, and if we want our kids back in school, we need to do some of the things that you spoke of.
Right.
I agree. We have to do this as a community.
Right.
And, you know, our administration, teachers, and staff are, in my opinion, doing everything that they can do to keep up, as what Dick said, the consistency.
Mm-hmm.
So our children, we're wrapping around as much as we can, and even going forward to do even more for them.
Right.
And so once we get the parents, the parents need to come on board with us and get into these sessions and do the things that we as a team can bring these children through, because it's all about them and their safety. And I think as a community, we can do this. There's nothing we've never been able to tackle in this community.
Right.
And this is just something that, you know, we're all going to learn from. Our children are going to learn from, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know,
resiliency.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And we, as the leaders and parents in this community, have to teach them it's okay if we have to do things different. We have a goal out here.
Mm-hmm.
And our goal is to get there and to get these children there.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, we have to do it together.
Right.
You know, when I saw this, because you shared this with us earlier,
mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of sense. It really does. And if we were in that range, I think our discussion tonight would have a different feel. I think the teachers would have a different feeling about their situation. I know we've had several people that said, well, you know, they're essential workers, you know, bring them back. So teachers, their job description is not that of what a policeman or nurse is, and people that are in those professions that get specialized training, get all sorts of additional equipment and so forth. teachers are by nature nurturing, caring individuals, and they are going to do everything that they possibly can do to try to make sure that the kids are successful. But at the same time, they have families and they have their own health that they have to consider. And I think if we, if our county and our school district can achieve what's up on that screen right now, the conversations that can be had within this district would be a lot different. I know I've said and kind of repeating, you know, we are at really the mercy of the community. The community has a lot more control over this situation than we have. Our political leaders have passed the decision down to us, you know, and said, you know, decisions about how to address this out of the governor's office, out of Washington, and then the local school boards need to make the decision. And I don't disagree with that. You know, as Ryan was talking about, we need to look at and make sure we're looking at our situation. Mm-hmm. And not, I don't care, honestly, the decisions of Dublin, North Union, Fairbanks. Hopefully they make all the right decisions for their mm-hmm. district. Right. The only school district I'm concerned about is this one. And I know that for me, you know, all of the comments and the questions and the frustrations and so forth that have been shared haven't been lost on me. They've all been part of the discussion. And, you know, it's been kind of a wandering journey coming to a decision tonight. You know, some things were rather hopeful. Some things have turned out not to be very hopeful. But I think, setting a goal in the future, saying this is the direction we need to go, this is where the community needs to be for us as a board to be able to make a decision is important.
And I do, you know, we've made several comments about some emails that we've received, and I think it's important to say that we have also received a fair amount of emails of people supporting mm-hmm. the current setting, the hybrid model, and, you know, just their gratefulness for the safety that it brings them, or the safe feeling that it brings them. So, you know, I think it would be wrong to not share the fact that we have received emails in support as well. And actually, since our meeting last week, I feel like we've received more in support than against.
I do too.
You know, so, and as we know, I mean, it's all over the place, you know, but I, at the end of all of this conversation, the words that stick out to me the most are consistency, just that importance of having consistency for our staff and our students and our family. And then, you know, one other thing that I had thought of, and then I saw it in a recent email, was that idea of quality versus quantity, and not just automatically equating more days in school to being a better experience. It may very well be, but if we can continue to find ways to improve this hybrid model, you know, maybe those 2 days in school and 3 remote days overall provide a better quality of education in this current setting. I don't know. So with that, I mean, I would say it sounds like we're giving you a direction to stay in the hybrid model for the time being and consider these kinds of guidelines or indicators as a possibility to for a framework to move towards that tiered return. Maybe touching base with the staff, sharing this with our staff and families as well, and saying, you know, is there anything else that would give you a better sense of safety or a better comfort level for moving in this direction?
I thought we'd also take it back to the task force.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, yeah. Yep.
And then will we be sharing, Diane, that this is our hope eventually to get back to the 4-day, but as where we stand right now with being in red, blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think, we will add those two graphs to the dashboard.
Good.
And COVID reporting that Mark created and keep those ongoing so parents and community members would be able to.
Okay. And when those, and then you talked about adding the quarantine numbers and, yes. You know, maybe having a note on that that says these quarantine numbers do not include other normal absences that we experience every year due to a variety of things like that. So, you know, because that's really one of our biggest challenges, I think, is just staffing, mm-hmm. staffing, potential staffing shortages.
Now, do you need to make a motion and a vote on that? Or I know we did on the original return, so I just want to make sure we're...
Okay. Well, yeah, we voted on the return model, so I'd be happy to make a... Well, I'll let someone else make the motion. If somebody would like to, just because generally as...
I make a motion that at the current status that we're at in our county level mm-hmm. of being red, that we continue to stay on our hybrid method of teaching.
Okay.
Before, then we usually, do we discuss first or do we...
Make the motion first and then discuss.
Mm-hmm. So somebody needs
to... So we have a motion. I'll second the motion.
Okay.
So one of the questions I have about that motion is, how much lead time do you need to plan if we're still staying open to the possibility of a tiered return in, let's say, mid-November? Like, how much lead time do you need to even start planning for something like that?
There are moving parts. Kind of, we've talked the whole time. We're going to have Virtual Academy kids returning at November 16th. We already have some ebb and flow going on, but we can, I would say at minimum a week.
Okay, so the way I would hear that motion, Amy, is it's not closing off the possibility of a tiered reintroduction in November. It's just we're not committing to it today because we're in the red.
Well, at the current status of being in red,
right.
We stay with our hybrid metal. Our model. That's how I stated it.
Right. But we're not saying that we're going to stay there necessarily past November if things improve. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair.
It's maybe a minor point, but we have said we were not going to tie our decisions to the color-coded state
mm-hmm.
criteria. So I think that within the motion stating that currently because we're in the red we're not going to move could send kind of a mixed message.
Right. Right.
So
well let me put it another way. Another thing that could happen between now and November, apart from the county's alert level changing, is we could get more definitive information that kids do better when they're in school, regardless of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So it's not just, when I say that we need to be doing better, I don't just mean the alert level. You follow me? There's a lot of school districts out there doing a lot of different things, and there's a lot of researchers that are collecting information, and we're going to know more in a month than we do now. I still think it's possible that we're going to be told by our public health people, send the elementary kids back. It's good for them. You follow me? So that's another thing that could change between now and November that would allow us to...
So I don't care how we state it. You know, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, whatever you feel the best way to state it, that we stay currently, right now, in the hybrid method until we get some more information or standings from the state, whatever, that, you know, at which point we take a turn and look at the next model.
Do we need to set a point in the future?
Many districts would say we're going to reassess in a certain amount of time.
Right. So reassess November, December, January?
What generally makes sense from a school operations standpoint is to revisit at the end of a grading period, and that's what we kind of approved at the beginning of the year, that as the end of the 9 weeks approached and into that trimester, because we have two different systems, right? Trimester and elementary.
Right.
So, I mean, it would seem to make sense from a school operations standpoint. That doesn't mean it has to be that way, but we would revisit then again at the end of the next grading period.
Which would be in that middle November time frame, right?
Trimester ends November, or the new trimester elementary begins November 16th.
Right. And then the semester is in January.
Correct.
So
would you have a suggestion as to when the board should potentially reconsider?
I mean,
Thinking of a couple things
I heard from all of you from sitting here listening was there was a concern about holidays approaching, increased social gatherings over that time. So I would wonder if it makes sense to reevaluate when we come back off a semester, or maybe in our December meeting, which tends to be a lighter agenda.
Right.
I would hope to have maybe this kind of criteria finalized for that November meeting, and then that can be the driving force, something to bring forward for you guys to vet through after it's been through a couple groups. Those are a couple things off the top of my head.
And, you know, the other reality, because, you know, we did receive that email asking about our current calendar shows a remote learning platform, which is kind of the next thing, which I think kind of ties into this. I mean, if we have a motion to remain in the hybrid model, then, you know, this next thing that we're going to talk about, that would mean instead of doing remote from Thanksgiving through the holidays, we would remain in hybrid during that time frame.
Correct.
And then reassess at the semester.
So we would not go to remote. We would stay in the hybrid, which is a level up from the total remote.
Because there were some concerns, you know, why go to remote when we're not having a lot of issues, and we're seeing some success in the hybrid. So
would a decision in December be better than a decision in mid-January from the operation of the district?
Yeah.
Most likely.
All right. Then, if I can, I'd like to
amend
the motion that we would stay in the hybrid system to be reconsidered at the regular board meeting in December.
I will second that motion.
Okay.
The first motion was much more open-ended than that. And I'm trying to express.
You would like that
flexibility. You know, things can change fast. So if we don't reconsider this until December, we're basically saying let's vote to stay in the hybrid into December, and that takes that
tiered
thing off the table. And I'm not sure that we need to do that quite so quickly. I thought what you were saying is let's stay in the remote model for now.
Absolutely. Now, here's what we've got coming up, Brian. So in November, we should totally rule that out because you got Thanksgiving and all of that. Okay, so kids are already off school. So we kind of want to, I mean, how are you going to even try to go back on a four-day when kids have the holiday in there? Okay, so we're putting our staff and the kids all in a really tough situation there to try to come back maybe 4 or 5 days on a full, you know what I mean? So if we take that out and then we vote on it in December, we come back and visit it in December, then the kids would have their holiday for Christmas and stuff, and then if we decide at that time that it looks good to go back, then as of the very beginning of the semester, then we're back to four, then we'll go to a 4-day. It's kind of like alleviating all the situations that could throw us into a non-consistent area by removing all the situations with the holidays and stuff like that coming up. But yet, we're giving more with going hybrid instead of total remote. So we've already stepped up one instead of going total remote.
Right.
Where the parents, you know, it's more of a burden for them. We've stepped that up and kept it at a hybrid now.
Right.
So I think that we ultimately need to just take that remote, put it into the hybrid, and then do our next assessment in December.
Well, the two plans, the two tenure plans, were put together by this team, and I presume they took all that into account, that it was happening right around Thanksgiving. So they had sorted that out, that it would, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So and again, I don't see why we need to take that tiered plan off the table tonight. I think a month is a long time. Between now and when that would start is a month. And just because we're in the red in Union County for a few days, to me, that doesn't warrant taking that entire plan off of the table tonight.
Well, we can always reserve the right to go back in and look at it.
Have a more open resolution that right now we're staying in the remote model.
No hybrid.
I mean, sorry, the hybrid model.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it also, though, is just making some decisions so that there's not a lot of question marks, not as many question marks out there for parents.
Right.
And that's my opinion. I would rather say, okay, yes, now I know what the plan is, and really the only chance for a change is if things got really bad and we had to go remote. But other than that, we're going to be in the hybrid. And we're going to see how things go and continue to look at, you know, whatever new information comes out.
The tiered plan, first of all, it doesn't start till November, and it only affects the elementary kids in November. So there's not even a plan on the table that brings the high school kids back before January.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So I think that your point that people have to be able to plan and we have to know what's coming up is fine, but I don't think we need to take the tiered reentry off the table tonight in order for people to make plans. Everybody's going to know we're still in hybrid for at least a month, even if we got elementary kids.
Yeah, I guess I'm suggesting not 1 month, but two.
There'd be 7 weeks of instruction between now, if I figured accurately, and winter break, which aligns with our board meeting in December,
right.
Pretty close.
Right.
So because of the holiday, so there'd only be
right.
7 weeks, right?
Right.
Right. And like you said, the original talk was potentially that the majority of that time frame, or 4 weeks of that, 3 or 4 weeks of that, was going to be all remote. Was potentially going to
right.
be all remote.
But we moved that to the next
right.
level now.
Right. Nanda, do you have any comments?
I think probably that we're dealing with a lot of moving parts with the holidays there,
mm-hmm.
and I think there is going to be a lot of risk with family gatherings. So I think maybe we should just wait till December and look, our next point of evaluation would then be in January. When we come back from Christmas, are we coming back into a tiered startup?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm kind of thinking long term. Number one, I do want the kids in school, especially
mm-hmm.
the young ones. I think that
right.
from an educational standpoint, mm-hmm. even though the data doesn't show a big shift, I think that there is an issue there. But also, I'm thinking long-term for the high school kids. I want the kids to have a prom,
yeah.
and I want the kids to have a graduation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when we get back to this is a community issue, okay, we need to get this under control, and we need to keep our eyes on the ball.
Yes.
I want spring sports. I want a prom. I want graduation.
Mm.
You know, I want the kids back in school, so I don't know if we can pull it together in less than 7 weeks as a community.
And I think by that time, by December, if we mm-hmm. have some criteria that you've approved, then that
yes.
drives the decision making and not
right.
December board meeting, January board meeting.
Right.
Right. We'll vet that through our various groups and get that feedback. I'll bring it back in November.
Yes.
And that might, to your point, Brian, give a, okay, if we meet these criteria, then we'll start the tiered system with our K-4 people. Right.
Which that we have heard that, you know, people are wanting some more specific metrics. So,
and I think too, if we go in and we say this is the plan right now, that's easy for, that's so much easier for a family, you know, to look at this is the plan. So this is the plan for only 2 weeks. What happens in 2 weeks? No, this is the plan right now, and this is where we're looking to carry this. Okay. This is, and then we're going to evaluate here. So it kind of gives them a guideline to look at as to where we're coming from, and helps them to schedule out their life over the next 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so
I want to make sure my amendment should include removing the reference to the red level and setting December regular board meeting as the next date when we would consider changes to the instructional method.
Correct.
Right. Okay. And your amendment then also, because I just want to make sure that it's very clear about that November time frame, that Thanksgiving to the holiday time frame, that, that your amendment would mean that the current calendar that shows a potential 100% remote would be revised to show hybrid instruction over that time frame. That's part of that. That is part of your amendment.
Yeah, that would be the effect of.
Okay.
My amendment.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So do we vote on
we
the
vote
first
on
one?
The
first one.
First.
Oh, we vote on the amendment first, and then on the okay.
And then the amendment.
Thank you,
motion.
Thank you, Mr. Mock Trial, and whatever. Okay. Any more comments?
Well, if I end up voting no, it's not because I disagree. It's not because I'm not taking in everything that you're saying.
Right. Oh, that's fine.
I respect everything you guys are putting into the. See where you're coming from. If I end up voting no, it's because I don't think we should take off the possibility that the elementary kids would go back in November. That's the only reason. But I agree with the idea of being clear that we're going to stay hybrid through the November, December. I like that.
Right.
Okay, and that we're going to be responsive to what's happening in the community and so on.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I think between the comments that you and I've made, the difference is just
minimal.
The time frame.
Right. 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 Because, yes.
Both of us are on the same page. We want the kids the tiered approach. I see as a possibility.
Right.
But I think we're just looking at a time frame in terms of when to reconsider that.
Right.
So.
I think we're all in that same boat. I mean, I think we all like the idea of a tiered return as soon as we can. So, and it's safe and feel safe about it. So, okay, then I would ask for a roll call on the amendment.
So just to be clear, So on a roll call for the amendment, Ms. Powers did the original motion. Does that mean that she's going to be considered the one who votes first?
Mr. Smith.
On the amended
motion. Because he made, yes.
Okay. On the amended motion, I would vote.
And then I second it.
Yes.
So that's just to amend it, not to pass it?
Right.
Correct.
That'll work. Okay.
Right.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Ms. Powers?
Yes.
Mr. Luke?
Yes.
Ms. Savage?
Yes.
Ms. Devine?
Yes. So the motion to amend the original motion passes. Now, do we vote on the original motion?
Now we vote on the amended.
Okay. Okay. Yes. So now we vote on the amended motion.
Ms. Powers?
Yes.
Ms. Devine?
Yes.
Mr. Luke?
No.
Ms. Savage?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Okay, motion carries. Okay. Did you have any other comments or any? Do we feel like we have been clear about our plans?
And we'll work on the communication.
Okay.
Took a lot to family.
Yeah. Okay. So the only other thing I wanted to make a comment on was I received an email today, and I'm pretty sure I know this flyer is going to be going out on Friday, but I received some information about free food distribution this coming Saturday, October 24th. It's part of the USDA's Farmers to Families Food Box. And our local Marysville Knights of Columbus are helping to organize this event. So at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m., there's going to be over 400 boxes available that are a 30-pound box of food that would include fresh meats, dairy, fruits, and vegetables. There are no income requirements, no questions asked. They ask that people please do not arrive before 11 a.m. But like I said, there should be our flyer email that goes on Friday would have the actual flyer. So if anybody out there knows of families who are really struggling, let's make sure that we try and connect with them and let them know about this program and just do whatever we can to help out. So with that, I would accept a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Motion by Ms. Powers.
Second.
Second by Mr. Smith. Roll call.
Ms. Powers?
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Mr. Luke?
Yes.
Ms. Savage?
Yes.
Ms. Devine?